powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
This is Tom, Jake, and Stacy on 710 ESPN Seattle. Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Tom Wassel, Jake Heaps, and Stacy Ross.
If you enjoy college football in the same way that I enjoy the NFL or college basketball or baseball, you are not feeling too good today. You are not feeling good
at
all. Yeah. I mean, multiple reports out there that representatives from all the Power Five conferences have gotten together both over the weekend and they're meeting again today to discuss whether or not they can even have a season. Why they've waited until now, I don't know. But it doesn't look like there are very good odds that we're going to have a season. That's what the word is right now. It just feels like there are too many variables. They can't protect the players. No uniform protocols for health, for COVID testing, etc. It just doesn't look good. Before we move on, let's hear from Dan Patrick breaking some news here. Cut number one, talking about what he's hearing.
Here's the information I got almost an hour ago. The Big Ten and Pac-12 will cancel their football seasons tomorrow. The ACC and the Big 12 are on the fence. The SEC is trying to get a delay to have teams join them. The SEC is looking at exclusive TV contracts.
Anybody hope that that UW joins the SEC for this season?
Can you imagine?
What would the record be? I mean, just to, you know, just to kid around.
I don't want to talk about it.
Wouldn't be good.
Wouldn't be great.
Well, either way, it's certainly not good news for anybody who's a college football fan. And I know that we could get into the debates about, well, what about the what about the kids that are not athletes, the ones that can't go to campus anyway, right? Why should student athletes get any sort of privilege or benefit above those kids? Like, that's a perfectly reasonable thing to ask as well. Okay, and there are arguments on both sides that make sense to me. I know normally we're supposed to come in here and be like, nope, we're having a college football season, or nope, we shouldn't have a college football season. This issue, I'm sorry, is just way too complex. It's way too complex. Anybody who comes in and says that they have it all figured out is full of it. Because if they did, they'd be at that meeting right now with those guys from the Power Five conference with the solution. Okay, nobody has the answers. No matter what they do, there's going to be consequences. If they don't play, there's going to be consequences for next year and for the NFL draft and this and that. If they do play, there's going to be consequences for that. Kids could get sick, right? That's the biggest one everybody's worried about, obviously.
Right. But so Tom, just one more thing,
Jake, before I get to you. I just want to say, because of those things, pointing the finger at people at the Power Five conferences or whoever, I think is useless. The only thing they didn't do right here is deal with this sooner. Why they're just meeting now, I have no idea. Because they knew that this was coming. Go ahead, Jake.
Well, I think the problem, though, is, Tom, you're talking about where's the breakdown? Where is the person with all the answers? Where's this and that? Nobody has a clear, perfect solution. But I think there was working solutions. There was situations where universities were working and operating. Jim Harbaugh comes out with a statement and showing very clearly the evidence of how it was working. But more importantly, the lack of uniform in all of this amongst universities and saying, hey, figure it out for yourself, to me is a fundamental, a absolute fundamental breakdown of the NCAA as an organization. Zero guidance, zero leadership, zero accountability. They just sit back and watch it all crumble. They watch this whole thing crumble. And what are you forking out millions upon millions of dollars to the NCAA to do? To be a governing body for the universities. Now, I know that it's probably an impossibility or very difficult for the non-Power Five schools to function financially, liability, all those things. To me, I understand why they are backing out of the season right now or suspending or delaying. But the Power 5 schools have the ability, and I believe have the ability to play, but they are not uniform in their protocols. They are not uniform in how they're working together. They're not uniform in exactly how they're going to go about their procedures, their protocols, and all that. And to answer the question, there has been a drastic change in college football in terms of the mentality of we are playing versus we are not playing, and that has changed very rapidly in the past week. And why is that? Because players have been calling for unionization, and they have been demanding that schools get their act together with COVID protocols and financial demands and all these things. To me, I think that was the tipping point that really changed and shifted the spectrum for these presidents of universities and for conferences in general to start going in this direction.
Yeah, Jake, you're right in that the NCAA dropped the ball and that these conferences, in theory, have the power to work together and make the NCAA more of a governing body. But I think the basic kind of fact of it not being that, and the fact that they didn't do that, that they didn't organize, at least that we can see, they either didn't do it or they did it and they did a bad job. It was one of the two things. They didn't organize and do a great job because now we're staring at having no season. The fact that they didn't do that, part of that to me is just the structure of the NCAA and NCAA sports as they are right now. And because of that, I don't know if it can handle a pandemic like the one we're facing. And, you know, I'm a big college football fan, a UW alum. I was very excited to see this season with Jimmy Lake. I know that you train with a lot of these kids. Like, we like college football. And I got to be honest, I didn't really seriously consider that the season couldn't happen. But the more I thought about it after this news came out, the more I thought, was it ever even a possibility? Like, is the NCAA as it's set up now with no kind of core governing body that actually has control over these schools and the Power Five conferences kind of do their own thing? And B, amateurism being what it is, how can you require that your athletes do something other students can't? They know it's a bad look, so they have to be cognizant of that. With those two things being the core of college sports, like, how can you function in a pandemic? I don't know if you can.
Well, I don't know if this is a fair way to look at it, but when you have other sports leagues functioning, I'm just trying to answer your question. Maybe we delude ourselves into thinking that the NCAA
absolutely
should be able to figure out a way. Because let's face it, we look at the NCAA as a sports league. We look at college football and the Pac-12 and the SEC and all that as sports leagues when really they're not supposed to be. I mean, they are, but that's where this whole thing gets murky. Like, do you treat this like it's a sports league that's, you know, funded in a certain way and that is tied to professional sports? You know, those agents are always not waiting, just, you know, waiting in the wings for those athletes to turn professional, and the NFL is waiting for them. Or do we say, nope, they're students, and it ends there? They shouldn't be on campus. They shouldn't get any benefits that any non-athlete gets, and the whole thing ends there. I mean, you've got players right now, guys like Trevor Lawrence, and the hashtag We Want to Play movement, who believe that they're safest on campus, isolated, away from other students who are not there right now, and also probably free from the dangers of contracting COVID at home. And he probably has a really good point. He has a really good point.
He does.
They might be safer there. But then you have to ask, okay, why should the athletes, the student athletes, be made safer than the rest of the students?
Well, I don't even look at it that way, Tom.
Why should they get that? Okay, but see,
I look at it as, why would you require
the
exactly? Why would you require the student athletes to do something that you're not requiring your students to do? If you say to your students, and this might be why the Pac-12 is seen as the conference that might do it first, because if you're a conference or a school that's saying we want all of our students to be learning virtually this fall, we don't feel we're comfortable having them on campus, or if at any point you close the campus and require that students can't be there, then the NCAA has backed itself into a hole because you say that your athletes are students and now you have to have them follow the same rules. I don't look at it necessarily as special treatment, although, like, no lie, I've always wondered what the athlete cafeteria would look like. But the idea of requiring your athletes to show up to campus and to play and to do all this stuff that you are telling your other students not to do does look bad. And that's a separate issue than whether or not they can even do it. I think the NCAA has kind of backed itself into that corner, and they know that, and I think they're worried about that.
I just want to respond, Jake, to what – hold on. I'm sorry, Jake. I just want to respond very quickly to what Stacey said there. But you're giving the students – or the athletes a benefit. Like, you're asking why require them to do something that the students wouldn't do. Well, but you're giving them an added benefit. Like, it's not a hardship that they're asking them to do. They're isolating them from COVID by keeping them on campus away from everything else. And giving them the opportunity to play, so that's good.
Right.
I mean, I don't understand why, like, they're not getting the shaft.
Go ahead, there's hypocrisy that is there. There's no question about that. But to Tom's point is that they are on scholarship. They are on scholarship there for a reason. And yes, sometimes when it comes to playing sports, 99% or 98% of the athletes, student athletes, want to play. So they're not being forced into the situation. So anybody acting like they're being forced into the situation, I think is, you know, dramatizing the situation. There might be 1% of student athletes that need to opt out because of health, underlying health conditions, or simply they just don't feel comfortable. But for the majority, everybody wants to play. And so if they are testing regularly, if they are putting protocols in place, and as Jim Harbaugh from the University of Michigan lays out exactly what they were doing and exactly the facts of the situation, that the Michigan football program had 11 positive tests out of 893 administered, three of them were included upon initial return to campus. And of the last 353 administered tests, there were zero positive tests. So There's a way to help these guys organize. And one thing that I want to say to back up what Trevor Lawrence was talking about is that actually having these student athletes on campus and in this basically bubble environment is safer for these athletes. Even before the pandemic, it was, you could ask every single captain, you can ask every single coach for any university. You know, the scariest time, the time that they were worried about their college athletes
the
most,
off-season?
It was breaks. It was the off seasons in which they were able to go home for holidays, when they were able to go home for this, that, and the other. There were always somebody that got into some sort of trouble, some sort of situation, and that was your number one concern. Is everybody going to make it back without any issues? And so if you're a college coach that worries about these things and your players that worry about your teammates because you know of the environments in which they are living in, then yeah, I think it's very reasonable to have that perspective and to point that out as to why this could be a benefit amongst all the chaos.
This hour of Tom, Jake, and Stacey is brought to you by Car Toys. We're going to catch up with Mike Saul coming up at 12:30. Reese Davis, host of ESPN's College Game Day, will be joining us at 1 o'clock. Reese is terrific. He'll have good perspective on this issue and more. We got a fight to talk about. The Astros got into another brawl. Maybe some Mariner talk. And right now in three questions, how does all this affect the Seahawks? Let's go.
It's time for three questions.
Can't wait for it.
Every day at 12 after 12, Tom Wassel's burning questions for Jake Heaps and Stacey Rost.
Enough with the "we gotta protect the kids" nonsense.
Every day, guys, that Jamal Adams trade is looking better and better. How is the value of the Seahawks' first-round pick next year looking if this season is canceled, Jake?
Awful. That value is awful. It is absolutely a gamble, a risk for any of these draft picks at this point in time, and for the Seahawks to be a late first round pick, that value is nothing, in my opinion. I mean, we're talking about last year, in this last draft, Joe Burrow, as I mentioned before, Joe Burrow was a guy that was at the bottom end of talent evaluations after his junior year at LSU after transferring from Ohio State. His senior year is when he explodes onto the scene, becomes the Heisman Trophy, has one of the greatest performances as a quarterback in college football history, and becomes the number one overall pick. So who knows how many stories would have happened like that from this year's college football season, and how drastically that would have changed the way NFL scouting talent and evaluators look at certain prospects. It's going to be really, really tough, and that's why I don't have a problem with this first-round pick going to the Jets whatsoever.
Man, giving up the first-rounder is still tough. Like, I don't want to take away the value of it completely, but I do think that someone like John Schneider has this in mind. He's looking at this upcoming draft, and he's saying, I'm not fully confident the NCAA football season is happening. If it happens in the spring, then could one of my top prospects that I'm looking at be injured, in which case he misses out on months or a full year of his rookie season here? So I think it certainly detracts from some of that value.
I think it's still got value. I mean, when the Jets go to use that pick, they're still going to have scouted players. They're still going to have looked at tape from the year before. There still may be a player that they really want, and they'll be able to exercise it that way. But I agree with you guys. Of all years to make this trade, of all years to give up that first-round pick, this is definitely the year to do it. Completely agree. Next.
Number two.
All right, the Astros got in a brawl with the A's. A pretty good one, actually. We always say how we don't root for injury. We feel bad even if the opposing team gets injured. Would you feel bad for an Astro player if they got seriously hurt in a brawl, Stacey?
Yes. If anyone, even an Astros player, was seriously hurt in a brawl, I would feel bad for him. I think that is a bummer. No one wants that. Do I feel bad any Astros player is involved in a brawl? No, not at all. So maybe those two things are in conflict. It's like, well, I hope no one gets seriously injured, but at the same time, like, you're doing this to yourself.
It's like watching a boxing match. It's like, I hope nobody gets hurt, even though they're going to punch each other, you know, to kingdom come for the next hour.
Right, and I'm going to tune in and watch, right? Like,
yeah.
Yeah, I don't want anybody to get hurt from the Astros. I'm not wishing that upon anybody, not in the slightest. And guess what? I don't think there will be anybody that gets hurt in a brawl, because after the quote-unquote brawl that we watched yesterday, that was nothing. Nothing even happened. And we're calling it a brawl? What's the standards for a brawl these days?
I think it was a scuffle. You know?
I don't know, man. That wasn't the weakest brawl I've ever seen.
But was it the best
brawl? There was anger involved. No, it wasn't. Definitely.
I like this question, though. What's a baseball brawl? What needs to happen? Because fists were in the air aimed at people's faces. Technically, punches were thrown. That's a brawl to me. If it's a close fist action, that's a brawl.
Yeah. I mean, I've seen guys get, you know, crack each other. The Kyle Farnsworth hitting Curtis may remember. Who did Kyle
Paul Wilson?
Paul Wilson, right. He hit him like a linebacker. Just drilled him right into the ground. That was a good one. Yeah, maybe yesterday doesn't measure up to that, but it wasn't bad. It was angry enough. It wasn't just like, you know, batter charges pitcher and immediately it gets broke up and they stand around for 10 minutes. That's weak. That wasn't what yesterday was.
I don't know. I saw a whole lot of pushing and shoving and a whole lot of nothing happening.
Jake was disappointed.
Jake's just a hardcore
guy. Jake was like, what
did
I pay for? We're like, what? You didn't pay at all. What are you talking about?
Well, just my favorite part was the initial guy that got into it. He goes and runs after the guy and then immediately gets taken down to the ground really nice and softly. Like, he almost like slides as he's getting tackled and just kind of stays there.
Oh, you mean Laureano? Well, yes. It was more weak on the part of the who was it? It was Alex Cintron. I don't know which coach, if he's whatever's
happening. He's their hitting coach.
Hitting coach. That was weak on his part. Because you see him and he's like initiating it, like, let's go. And then Laureano runs at him and then he's kind of like ducking behind his players, but then puts the fist up late. Like, that's how I would get in a fight. Like, hold me back. No, grab my arm. Hold me back. Hold me back from this person.
Next. The best way to be involved.
Number three.
Told you about the hashtag we want to play movement led by Trevor Lawrence, Clemson quarterback. If we polled all student athletes, how many would say that they want to play and not play? What do you think the percentages look like? Like, just the other day, the hashtag We Are United group was saying they were wanting to boycott, and now they've somehow joined We Want to Play. I don't really know how that makes sense. But, again, what do you think those percentages look like? We want to play, we don't want to play. What do you think, Jake? You know these people.
99.5%. 99.5% of these players want to play. Even the ones that are saying that they're going to boycott, to me, I believe that they are hoping that when push comes to shove, that the NCAA or that the Pac-12 or the Big Ten, that they're going to give in to their demands or cave in a little bit to satisfy them enough so that they can play. I have a hard time believing that a big percentage of these players would be willing to opt out of the season if there was one going on. So 99.5% of these players, Tom, and I feel very confident saying that, are willing to play and wanting to play.
Yeah, I think Jake's right. Obviously, he's been closer to this action than either of us, but just working at least around athletes, I think that you dedicate your entire life to something, you're serious about it, you're passionate about it. It's not fun to get up at like 5 a.m. and work out or do physical therapy or anything. So I think the vast majority of athletes love their sport and want to play, but I think that they're also starting to advocate for either a change to the NCAA as a whole, or just being open about not feeling like their school has their safety in mind.
Well, also one other thing to look at, Tom and Stacey, is the NFL. How aggressive is the NFLPA in terms of being willing to hold out? Now, we can get into the dynamics and the power dynamics of that, but ultimately, why is that? Why do they struggle? Because to really, you know, be willing to hold out, because A, they have a legitimate clock on their bodies, yep, because of how physical the game is. And B, they also know that they need to maximize it now. They don't have guaranteed contracts. NCAA football players don't have guaranteed money waiting for them down the line. They need to play. They need to improve their draft stock. They need to, you know, give themselves an opportunity to play at the highest level. Very few, if rare, any of them outside of Trevor Lawrence and a couple of these guys could afford to sit out and have their draft stock actually be helped by this situation.
We need to address if you guys think 95% of them want to play that badly and would do it for
99.5.
Okay. And would do it without being paid.
Well, they don't have a choice.
I know, but you get, okay, then why do they need people who are in our position advocating for them, saying that they need to be paid? If 99 would be willing to play for free in the face of a pandemic, that just doesn't make sense to me. You know what? We'll ask Mike Salk about that next, if I can maybe formulate that question a little bit better. 710 ESPN Seattle.
You're listening to Tom, Jake, and Stacey.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Tom Wassel, Jake Heaps, and Stacey Rost.
Great to have Mike Salk in with us on this college football issue. You know what? I also need to recommend that everybody go to brockandsalkpodcast.com and listen to any conversation / argument that Brock and Mike have on the issue of, oh, I don't know, paying players, whether or not college football this season is feasible, because they both do a terrific job. Mike, what do you think is the biggest thing getting in the way of having a college football season? Like, if you could point to one thing, and there are many, but if you could point to one, what is it?
A magnanimous leader. There's no leadership in college football. There's no commissioner of the sport. These are a collection of, you know, leagues and really a collection of teams. Brock will say they're almost, you know, 150 LLCs that are all sort of out there working for themselves. No one's in charge. There's no leadership. There is no Roger Goodell. You can complain about his leadership, and certainly I have and I will again. You can complain about what you get from the commissioner of the NHL, Gary Bettman, or what you get from the other leagues, but there at least somebody in charge making decisions. There is nobody in charge in college football. And so there's no one to schedule this. You see this pop up in various ways each year and on different issues, but I think you're seeing some of the real danger of it right now. The left hand doesn't know what the right is doing. And so the Pac-12 is going to cancel. We'll see what happens with the Big Ten. I mean, the Pac-12 cancels like a tree falling in the forest. I don't know how much of an effect it'll have on the other conferences. The SEC may just chuckle and say, great, we never respected you much of anything anyway, so go ahead and cancel. The SEC is the only type of football that really matters. But I think this could lead to all kinds of realignment eventually. And, Tom, I think you're in the same boat as me. I'm just trying to determine, and Brock and I are going to spend some time talking through it tomorrow when we record our podcast, how the reactions to COVID-19 are intermingling with the unionization / we are united, you know, players' rights, and how all of this is fitting together, because it sure seems like it's creating a lot of strange bedfellows at times.
It does, Salk, and that's the crazy part about this is, you know, my question to you is going to be, since that has happened, we are united. There's been a, you know, last second push here by Trevor Lawrence and a bunch of the players, # we want to play, we want to coach, whatever you call it. But over the last week, there has been a huge difference in terms of the attitude towards college football and playing college football at the very top. I mean, do you think that that is really the direct correlation between what is happening now and that movement, you know, coming out publicly?
I really can't tell, to be honest with you, Jake. It's so hard to say. And, you know, the way messages get lost and translated like a game of operator. I mean, We Are United starts as a message saying we're not going to play unless you satisfy our demands. A week later, it's we are united. We want to play. Please satisfy our demands so that we can play. I mean, you know, just sort of the way these things are used, and I don't know how much are, you know, people trying to determine how much leverage they really have. Here's what I do know. There's two issues at stake. One is health and safety. The other is money. And everything we're seeing, in my view, is some level of friction between those two giant competing forces. Health and safety on one side and straight up cash on the other. And everything is trying to determine who gets the money and whether or not their health and safety is taken care of and for how long. And I you know, if you're going to ask me which of those things is going to end up trumping the other, I think that the history of college football shows me that it is all about money over health and safety. So are they going to play? Maybe, maybe not. It's possible they don't. If they don't play, will it be because of COVID-19 or will it be because of their fear of everybody unionizing? And I don't know the answer to that question.
Do you think they actually could have done it with no change at all to the structure of college football as it is today? Do you think that even if the Power Five commissioners all met and spent weeks deciding on what they thought was a good plan to have the season, do you think it actually could have happened?
Yeah, I think it could have in some way, shape, or form. You know, again, I'll keep saying the same thing I've said all along about the effect of the pandemic, which is, look, we've seen players in baseball test positive. We've seen teams shut down for a short amount of time. Have you heard of anybody going to the hospital? Have you heard of anybody on a respirator? Have you heard of anybody who's died across Major League Baseball? I haven't heard of any of those things. So, and I'm not saying that it's not a danger, that it could happen. Certainly those things are a possibility. But until they do, I find it difficult to look at this and say that it's impossible to keep playing. They've shown so far in baseball through the first few weeks that it is possible. And they're not doing it in the bubble environment that the NHL and NBA are doing. Clearly, that is working better for those leagues, which is great. And if that were a possibility in football or baseball, I would be right there for it. It doesn't sound like it was. And yet, regardless, baseball's managing. And yeah, players have gotten sick and then they've come back, because for most healthy people, that's where this virus affects them. Now, again, the moment it affects somebody differently, and that's certainly a possibility here, you may absolutely see them shut down baseball. But without someone going to the hospital on a respirator or, God forbid, passing away, I just don't believe they're going to end up making changes.
Mike, I asked Jake and Stacy what percentage, if we were to pull every student athlete out there, what percentage would want to play right now under the current conditions and the current setup, and how many would not? They both agreed that it's really high, like 95, 99%
yep.
would want to play. If that's the case, why do they need people like us? Or why do we think that they need people like us to be advocating for them to be paid?
To be paid or to play? Which should you say?
To pay. Or to be paid. Because they're willing to play for free in the face of a pandemic right now.
I think that it's difficult for a college kid to understand the full scope of what's happening around them. And certainly I say that having been in college what is now starting to feel like too long ago, I don't think you really have too much of an understanding of what else is going on in the world. Again, a lot of my issues with not paying college players has very little to do with them and more to do with the enormous amount of money being made off the back of their labor. It's not that I think that they're out there and need to be clamoring for pay, although I think it's interesting that some of them are starting to take some of those matters into their own hands, and I commend them for that process. It's more about just the idea of the whole thing is just so gross. I would be fine with not paying college athletes and not paying everybody else as much money as they make. I just think it's gross when you see these gigantic television deals, et cetera, and knowing that the product, the kids who are actually out there doing the work, aren't getting any of it. There's an intrinsic fairness issue to me that just doesn't make sense. And if the NCAA wasn't making an enormous amount of money off its CBS, ESPN contracts, Fox, et cetera, I don't think I'd have nearly the same problem with it.
You know, you bring up a really interesting point there. Like, do kids that age understand the full scope of what's going on around them on this side of it? But then you see things like We Are United, and you ask the same question. Like, do they understand what they're getting into if they're going to boycott this, and if they think they can make demands, you know, A through K? Like, that was where my head first went.
Those are really good questions. When I was their age, I was just trying to figure out if they were going to kick us off campus for having too many noise complaints. I mean, like, you know, the level of thought that goes into the world around you when you're 20 years old is just not what it is 5, 10, 15, 20 years later.
Right. Agreed. Great stuff, Mike. Thanks. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
Did you guys watch the golf? Or you can talk at all about the golf? I just quickly have to say,
in the timeline. What do you want to
say? That was, Stacey,
yeah.
That was, I think, one of the best sporting events I have watched in ages. Now, granted, there haven't been many in the last few months, but that was unbelievable drama yesterday. Huge kudos to Colin Morikawa. What he did on 14 and then 16 was special. So for anybody who was watching yesterday, I hope you were jumping up and down the same way I was.
He also joins a very kind of rare group of players, which I'll talk about at 1:45.
Oh, nice.
Thanks, Mike. You can hang up.
See you guys.
Bye, Mike.
Bye. Five questions entering Seahawks training camp, according to one Stacy Ross. We get into him next. 710 ESPN Seattle.
You're listening to Tom, Jake, and Stacy.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studio.
Streaming through the 710 Sports app and on 710sports.com.
Now here are your hosts, Tom Wassel, Jake Heaps, and Stacy Ross.
I'm so glad I got into radio. It allows me to hang out with really weird people like Stacy Ross.
Wow. Okay.
It would be so boring otherwise.
I think I'm a fun, cool, And popular person, Tom.
Now that would be boring.
Okay.
Tom never said you weren't those things.
You're right. You're right. Just weird.
Weird is good. Weird is always good. The weirder the better when it comes to hanging around me. I don't want to hang out with no boring people. All right.
Okay.
Good question posed here by Stacey Ross. By the way, you're going to have five questions entering Seahawks training camp. Today's question, very key. Who is the starting nickel corner? And you could really make a case for, I think, three out of the five guys we're going to be taking a look at here.
Yep.
But I want Stacey to kind of lead the way and maybe go most likely to least likely. Why don't we start that way?
Okay. So here's the thing. My most likely, I have tied. And maybe Jake feels differently about this, but I feel like particularly since the Seahawks traded for Jamal Adams, they have kind of a depth at the secondary that they didn't have last year, and now they're looking for a way to get their second overall pick from last year, Marquise Blair, on the field. So I would have said, Ugo Amadi, it's his job to lose, period. Jake was advocating for this kid last year, but now I think it's a little more neck and neck. So I'm going to take a look at Ugo Amadi first, and then I'll jump to Blair. So Ugo Amadi, if you guys remember, was a front runner for this role, and Pete Carroll said at one point earlier this year that it was his job to lose. Again, the team traded for Jamal Adams, and I think now Marquise Blair, it feels like kind of like a wasted talent if you're not getting him out there. So he was a fourth-round pick out of Oregon. The one advantage he has in this competition is that he is kind of like a Swiss Army knife of players. He's played at corner. He's played at safety. And he's played as a nickel corner. So he has the experience there. He started out winning the job coming out of camp. Then he injured his arm, and they re-signed Jamar Taylor, and then they cut Jamar Taylor, which kind of cleared the way for Ugo Amadi to get back out there. But he seemed to be the guy playing that role toward the end of the year. Jake, I know he was a guy you kind of had your eye on for that role all season, and you wanted him to get even more reps.
Yeah, to me, Ugo Amadi was a player that I really enjoyed, and I thought did an outstanding job through the preseason. Just seemed to be one of those players that was an excellent special teams guy that could work himself into a nice role. And it was unfortunate that he got hurt early on, as you had mentioned, because later on in the season, I thought he played really well. And it didn't mean that he was perfect. He obviously gave up some big plays, but that's going to happen when you're a rookie. As you're trying to fill out this process and fill out your role. But it's going to be really important for them to figure out and solidify this position, because also in your article on 710sports.com, Stacey, you talk about the percentages of how much the Seahawks played base defense and base personnel. This last year in 2019, they were far and away the leading
not even close
in that personnel 69% of the time. And traditionally, you look at when they had Justin Coleman, 2018, 34% of the time is when they were in base defense. And in 2017, they were just in 29% of the time. So this is a defense that is used to playing with a good nickel corner. Mm-hmm. And so the next guy that you could look at that plays that role is Marquise Blair, somebody that they've talked about and that Pete Carroll's tried to find a role. And I think personally, you have those three safeties, Jamal Adams, Marquise Blair, and Quandre Diggs. I think that's a pretty exciting group of guys to have out there on the field that have speed, that fly around, are physical, and have presence.
Absolutely agree. Marquise Blair especially drew a lot of attention. That was because of this comment from Pete Carroll recently.
For the most part, we have to figure out Marquise. He's the one that's going to get the opportunity to get in on the slot and do some stuff that puts him in a position to be really active and be part of the pressure packaging and some real aggressive part of the play.
So now they're clearly intrigued by his hard-hitting style. I don't know that he has quite the versatility that Ugo Amadi did, having played that position before, but he's got a lot of talent, a lot of potential, and he's someone that it's clear the Seahawks don't want to waste. And he's not going to beat Jamal Adams out. He's probably not going to beat Quandre Diggs out. So this is a guy that's looking at fitting in either a nickel or a dime package. Obviously, you have him as a depth piece. But again, I love you pointing out those percentages of the kind of how often the Seahawks were in base defense, Jake, because I think one of the reasons we're not going to see that this year isn't just because Pete Carroll already hinted at it. It's because this team has a depth at safety, even at the corner position, that they didn't have before, which brings me to the one I think might be least likely is Trey Flowers. I say that because now with Quentin Dunbar coming off the commissioner's list, he's going to be able to participate with the team in training camp. People have him pretty much penned in as the starter there. Obviously, it's still a competition between him and Flowers, but Flowers could be another guy where you've got a guy that used to be a starter, and now he's your backup, and you just have a bevy of young talent that you spent draft capital on, and you don't have a place to play them. So I think it's going to be tempting to kind of stray away from base defense a little more and lean into the secondary members that you have.
Here's what I love about the secondary right now for the Seahawks is they've got enough young talent and depth that they can actually start to play matchups. They can put Marquise Blair in the slot. They can put Jamal Adams in the slot. They can put Dunbar in the slot, or Ugo Amadi for that matter, depending on the personnel of what each team presents out there. And to me, now you're starting to play winning football, because now it's not just about, hey, this is what we do, but we, you know, this is who we are. We're a cover three. We're a man-to-man team, and we like to play with those principles. But we can start to match up our personnel against yours and try and find the favorable one that works for us. That's all of the things that they have to figure out. And you talk about Trey Flowers, Stacey. I would not be surprised if Quentin Dunbar actually, in certain situations, would come down into the slot and put Trey Flowers out there on the outside. It's not the traditional thing that you see, but I could see that happening, because Dunbar has had history of playing in the slot, covering the best receiver on the field. He's very comfortable doing that.
Yeah, that's exactly why, Tom, you talk about the guys I said were most likely. I think primarily we're going to be hearing about a competition between Marquise Blair and Ugo Amadi, but if Trey Flowers is maybe the least likely person in there, somewhere in the middle is the wild card. Like Jake said, I've got Quentin Dunbar and Quandre Diggs. Both of them have experience there. And even though I expect them to be your starting corner and free safety respectively, I still wouldn't be shocked to see them being part of the competition at nickel.
This is kind of a off the topic question, but we're about to wrap here anyway.
Okay.
If they had gotten Jamal Adams earlier in the offseason, because they got Dunbar, they traded for Dunbar pretty early, and they knew that they had Adams, do you think that it might have been smart to try to move Marquise Blair, to try to trade him? Like, where is his value the highest? Is it as a depth piece? Is it as a nickel corner? Or is his talent enough or known enough to the league where maybe trying to trade him to get something else might have been the way to go?
It's a good question. I really do believe Marquise Blair still has a tremendous value on this team. I think that they can find a role for him as the nickel corner, as somebody as a depth piece. And also, you got to look at this long term. Is, you know, they are, I believe, going to be signing Jamal Adams to a long-term deal. I hope so at this point.
Yeah,
but that seems to look like that's a done deal. But Quandre Diggs, he will be a free agent after the 2021 season. So that's something, or after the season. So that's something you have to look at as well in terms of what do they make with that extension. So Marquise Blair still has a lot of value to this team.
Who?
Marquise? Diggs.
Diggs? What is he, 25?
Diggs is a little old. He's a little older than that. I think he might be 26, Stacey. I think you might be right on that.
Okay.
He's 27 years old.
Okay.
He's 27 years
old. Okay, but if he plays well, wouldn't you want to extend him?
Yes, you would. You want to keep that group together.
So anyways, this series, the first one is on 710sports.com. That's the conversation we just had about the nickel cornerback job. There's going to be four other articles that are released this week, and that's leading up to August 17th, which is when we'll start our two-a-day series, for which Jake will be present.
Yay!
Yay!
Yes. Yes, I will be. I'll be there.
All right.
Ready.
Reese Davis, the host of ESPN's College Game Day. Boy, he's not going to have much to do if there's no college football season. We'll ask him what he has planned instead next. 710 ESPN Seattle.